Hi, it's Hamish McDonald here. I'm a journalist and I've been investigating mis- and disinformation. If you're worried that something you're seeing, reading or hearing from an ABC host might be mis- or disinformation, especially if it announces an emergency or an investment opportunity, then try stopping and searching for other pieces of their reporting on the same topic on ABC brand websites and broadcast channels to verify its accuracy. If you want to join me interrogating the dark world of disinformation, stream The Matter of Facts now on ABC iView.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
There are two men in court for the murder of Irma Palasik, but in the final stages of this trial, questions have been asked about a third, leading to some fiery exchanges and tense moments in front of the jury. I'm Stephen Stockwell. This is episode 9 of the case of the two intruders.
Irma Palasik's brutal murder rocked her family and has haunted them for 24 long years.
This wasn't the average robbery.
The brutality of the attack shocked the community.
They were virtually tortured that night.
Violently assaulted before the two men ransacked the premises and stole cash and jewellery.
My grandparents were beaten and my grandmother was left to die on the lounge room floor.
The prosecution's case rests on evidence from two items taken from the Palasik's home that they say link to the accused in court. In the last moments of the case, there has been the dramatic reveal of the water jug and the milk bottle at the centre of this. And there for all of it has been ABC Canberra court reporter Elizabeth Byrne. G'day, Liz.
Hi, Stocky.
And as well as Elizabeth, we're also very lucky to have, as always, ABC investigative reporter James Viver. James, how you on?
Hi, Stocky. Yeah, there has been a lot of drama. Looking forward to getting into it.
Yeah, the dramatic reveal is something I'm very keen to discuss, and I know you're both keen to get into as well. But before we dive in, Liz, can you give us an idea of where we're going to be heading in this episode?
Well, this week we reached the final lap with the end of the Crown case, and the battle lines have become clearer after days of evidence from the lead detective, Craig Marriott, who faced close questioning over why he focused his investigation on Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Facconi and didn't go wider. More details have emerged about the white van and the contamination of a roll of tape. And finally, the jury heard the details contained in statements from Shannon Dunn, a man who told police soon after Irma was killed that he was there with a group of others.
Thank you, Liz. I really want to talk about Shannon Dunn. As I mentioned at the start of this episode, this whole case is about two men. It is about Steve Fabrizi and it is about Joseph Facconi, who are in court charged with the murder of Irma Palasik in 1999. And as we're reaching the end of this trial, there is now another name that has been put before the jury, Shannon Dunn. It was in kind of passing at first. He sort of mentioned briefly here and there. And over the last few days, he's really kind of become a bit of a focus. Who is this person and how did he come to the attention of police?
Well, how he came to the attention of police was that he was in a mental health unit and he told a couple of people who worked there that he'd actually been there when Irma Palasik's house was being burgled. So he was inside the Palasik's house, but with a group of other people. But he said when he saw things becoming violent, he and his friend took off and the other people were remaining. So that's how he came to the attention of police, basically that he'd gone there to do a robbery with other people and got cold feet.
Yeah, interesting. And James, any connection with Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Facconi in that?
Well, no, is the short answer. That's what Craig Marriott told us in his evidence in various ways and in various times and through various people, all three barristers at the bar table from either end. But there was no link that police could find between any of the people, in fact, any of the people on the long list of persons of interest, and Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Facconi.
Right. I mean, this sounds like, at the time, what would have been such a promising lead, right? You know, you're in the late 90s, you're investigating this murder, and you hear word of someone who says they were there. At the time, we've heard about Bob Peters, the investigator who was leading the investigation in the late 90s and early 2000s. Liz, surely this is something that he followed up. What did we hear about how he looked into this and tried to establish whether or not Shannon Dunn was involved?
Well, you're right. He investigated this fairly enthusiastically at the time, and he tried several times to get statements from Shannon Dunn and talk to him about what he said he'd done at the time. Now, Shannon Dunn always shied away from saying he was there or took part in any violence. He always said that he left because he was upset by the violence. Mm. And Bob Peters looked into this. At first he said that he felt that Shannon Dunn might have seen the posters with the reward on it, but later he admitted there was no evidence that had actually happened. But he did form the view that Shannon Dunn was an attention seeker and that he was trying to ride on the coattails of somebody else's crime. So that was what was said to the court sort of early in the hearings and then later reiterated, because Bob Peters was recalled only in the last week to answer some more questions from Mr. Fabrizi's lawyer, Sky Jerome.
Yeah. And I mean, we haven't had Shannon Dunn in the courtroom for any of this. He hasn't given evidence. How's this information being presented to the court? How are you hearing about all of this?
Well, this was quite interesting. Sky Jerome read sections of the statements that, and I think there were something like three of them that had been received from Shannon Dunn over the period. And this was all happening in sort of about 2000. And she would say to Detective Craig Marriott, who of course led the final investigation, does the statement say this? And then read it out. And that way she was able to get those statements in front of the jury so they would know what was said. Now, those statements were quite interesting in that each one was a little bit different. You know, the car changed colour, the car that they'd gone to the alleged burglary had been different in one account to another. In another one, he said he and his friend got out at the lights and ran away when they realised that there were people home. So there were a few differences in each of his accounts. And this is what led police to describe his account as fanciful.
It was interesting, yeah, as Liz says, each time the different iterations that we heard from Shannon Dunn, albeit indirectly and some decades later, there were these details that change, and he seemed to get further and further away from the house. As Liz says, it was the lights before, then it was a couple of blocks, and the story changed. These were some of the inconsistencies that police say led to them discounting these admissions as being fact.
And one of the things to point out here, Stocky, is the judge warned the jury several times that this technique of reading out the statements and getting Craig Marriott to agree, that was what was in the statement. The jury was to learn about those things, but it was only by way of informing them about what the police had considered. They didn't have to accept what was said in those statements as the truth.
Right, got it. It is a really interesting kind of development of, you know, Shannon Dunn saying he's at this house, right? Because you've got this young guy who at one point we've heard had blonde hair, and we heard from Irma's statement following the robbery at her house in 1998 that one of the people there had blonde hair. And then you've also got Shannon Dunn who has an Australian accent. And as Gregor described, the person, you know, breaking into the house in 1999 asking, where's the money, where's the money? Someone who had an Australian accent. Was any of this put to Craig Marriott, the lead investigator, by the defence? It seems like something that they would have jumped on and really drilled into.
Yes, it's a key part of this whole case. And Sky Jerome really drilled into Craig Marriott's investigation and basically asked him, had he gone into this investigation without having an open mind? Because he focused completely on Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Facconi and didn't look at these earlier leads in the investigation. And she suggested that that was at odds with. He had this theory that it was two men, not three, and that he'd been so wedded to that he hadn't looked at the other possibilities.
James, how does Craig Marriott kind of respond to that? How does he push back at the suggestion that he didn't investigate this properly?
Well, when we watch movies and TV shows about court cases, you know, they're always quite shouty and there's always a big moment, a big aha, you can't handle the truth moment. Mm. In actual fact, certainly in this case anyway, and I'm sure Liz would agree, that they're not really like that. They're sort of long and there's lots of detail and they're quite often a bit boring. However, there were a couple of moments in the last few days where, you know, we got as close to you can't handle the truth moment as I think we've got through the whole case. And so to answer your question, not very well. How it sort of unfolded in this particular instance was they're talking about Shannon Dunn and they're accusing him of not doing his job properly, basically for not following up these leads. Mm. As it turns out, Craig Marriott, on the request of the Crown, had gone in January of this year to take a statement from Shannon Dunn, updating things. However, when they were discussing this, should we say, or rather when Sky Jerome was questioning Craig Marriott about this, she said to him, you're getting pretty defensive about the Shannon Dunn evidence. And he said, well, no, I'm not getting defensive about the Shannon Dunn evidence. I'm getting defensive about you accusing me of going into this interview and this taking of the statement with Shannon Dunn with a closed mind, essentially translating, saying I'm not doing my job properly. The other flashpoint was when Sky Jerome put to Craig Marriott her theory, or the defense's theory, of the third man being in the house. Now, this was something that was rejected pretty out of hand by Craig Marriott. He said, what third man? There is no evidence of a third man. Sky countered by saying, you know, you've never investigated, how do you know? His argument, or his evidence that he gave in return to that, was no one at any point has ever brought up the idea of a third man other than you, including the two defendants, despite being given the opportunity to do so via police interview and other means, in terms of Steve Fabrizi and his undercover operation, and albeit he didn't know it at the time, as well as, of course, Gregor Palasics, who in his interview that we've heard about in previous pods in the hospital with the two officers at his bedside in the hours after, at no point mentioned anything other than there being two men in the house. And in rejecting this third man theory, Craig Marriott then said to Sky Jerome, this is why the DNA evidence of your client is so critical. And Sky Jerome didn't like that particularly much. And that's when the accusations of Craig Marriott grandstanding were made by Sky Jerome, and Justice Mossop had to step in and sort of separate everyone back into their relevant areas and encourage them not to have a debate over whether one was grandstanding or the other was, or who was in the right and who was in the wrong, but just to stick to the questions and reminding Mr. Jerome that the witness is allowed to answer however he wishes, even if it was a yes-no question that was asked.
Yeah. And yeah, the way you describe how Craig Marriott goes about this investigation, James, is really interesting, because there's hundreds of people that have been looked at. You know, Craig Marriott, we heard saying, I think, 333 persons of interest when you include Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Vicconi. But his job, it doesn't sound like, was ever to go through all of those individuals once he took on the case, right? Like he was kind of working, I guess, backwards in a way.
Yeah, an unfortunate description that he used, but he said, yeah, we took a backwards approach, which I don't know if I'd have used that language myself, but that's the language that he used. But what that means is, and it makes sense when he explained it, is that you go, okay, well, we've got this new piece of information, extremely important DNA profile that has matched Steve Fabrizi, or rather, and we've discussed the numbers, but we'll shorthand it for matched for the purposes of this conversation. We have a DNA identification of Steve Fabrizi. We work backwards from that. So what that means is you go, okay, who is Steve Fabrizi? Where was he at the time? Where is he now? What are or are not his criminal associations, backgrounds, convictions, and so on? And then you work out from Steve Fabrizi in concentric circles, and you see if some of those 331 other people somehow mesh in with associations, timelines, so on and so forth. And as we discussed, they do not. It's the reverse of what you do, as Craig Marriott described, in a normal police investigation, which is where you gather absolutely everything you know, you start with the net wide and you come inwards. And so he was really interesting in describing it that way. And in his re-examination from the Crown, was able to give some of that information and delivered that to the jury at a bit more length. He had a bit more latitude, as you would imagine, to do so. So in defending why he hadn't followed up a lot of these old leads, he said, well, that work's already been done. That's yep. already been ruled out. Why would we go back over old ground when we have this new piece of information?
And he also said that everybody else had looked at all these things for 20-odd years, and he had the advantage of an identification, and that's what he swung the whole investigation off.
Yeah, and I mean, the undercover operation, we've got a little bit more detail from as well. That's the kind of the culmination of the Craig Marriott stage, I suppose, of the search for who killed Irma in 1999. And in that, he brings in Steve Fabrizi, one of the accused in this trial, to a fake criminal gang. And we've spoken a lot about that in one of our previous episodes, which if you haven't heard, I recommend jumping back into and checking out. But from Craig Marriott in the last week, James, we've had a little bit more information about how that worked, including how much Steve Fabrizi was paid for his work. Was he making bank?
Well, I don't know how to measure that or not, but I don't know if this is or isn't a lot of money in as far as fake criminal syndicates. But he was asked directly how much was he paid, and it was a short but informative answer: $10,000. So this was over the course of the undercover operation, which obviously Steve Fabrizi thought was his gradual involvement in an introduction to this fake criminal syndicate.
Yeah. And also interesting hearing Craig Marriott, you know, sitting next door in Crown Casino, listening to the recording or listening to the interview as it's going away. Maggie asked a question in our last episode about how much Steve Fabrizi was paid. So, Maggie, hopefully that's answered your question. Well, it has answered your question. Not hopefully. That is the amount. So
I don't think he got to keep it, though, Maggie. it would be my guess. We haven't heard that in court, but that is an educated guess.
Yeah. We'll see. Maybe we'll hear a bit more about that when the trial wraps up. As well as Shannon Dunn, you know, something else that's been a real target of the defence in the trial of Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Ciccone has been this white van and this roll of tape. Now, the roll of tape is something that has supposedly had Irma Plasek's blood on it. And we've heard in previous episodes that this was kind of ruled out despite having that blood. And that really surprised me. You know, it seemed like such a key piece of evidence. I was surprised that it was kind of pushed to one side, but we've had more detail on what happened there, how that unfolded from the man who examined this roll of tape, a man called David Royds. Liz, who is David?
Poor David Royds. He was a forensic investigator in 1999, and his job was to take things out of their evidence bag, examine them to see if there was anything there. And if there was a chemical test to be done, that was his job as well. He was an expert in this area. Unfortunately, things went terribly wrong for him in this instance. So the white van was found. It was one of the many stolen vehicles the police looked into at the time. And the white van was found a little way away from where it had been stolen. This is because it barely went at all. It had been started with a screwdriver because they found the screwdriver was still stuck in the keyhole. And it was stuck in second gear or something. It was almost useless. But there was a roll of tape found there, which was found to have, by David Royds, a couple of little specks on it, and he tested it for blood, and the test was positive. So he sent it off, and that was Irma Palasek's blood. But when he thought about it over the weekend, he realised that the little specks were the wrong kind of thing. They were hard-edged cubes, which signified dried blood, as opposed to if it had been at the crime scene, it would have had softer edges picked up from wet blood. So he went and told his boss, and unpleasant things followed, which seriously limited his career because it was realised that he hadn't cleaned the examination room properly and he must have picked up something off one of the other exhibits. So that's how, I suppose, the white van and that tape was sort of set aside as a contamination issue, one of the points that the defence has been raising continually. But the white van caused a whole lot of problems because because of that blood, they'd had to search every single little bit of it, and no more blood was found, and nothing else was found in the white van, which was an electrician's van and had also been ransacked, a bit like the Palasik's home.
It's such an uncomfortable experience, you know, having to make that mistake in the first place and then relive it again 26 years later or wherever we are now, 27 years after the fact, to have to go back and explain your mistake over and over again under the particularly sort of penetrating gaze of criminal barristers, defence and prosecution. I mean, talking about contamination, Liz, this is something that the defence has focused on throughout this trial. Has there been contamination in the DNA at any stage? They must have seized on this. They must have jumped on this revelation from David Royds that he'd made a mistake as part of the investigations into this murder.
Yes, they did. And they also seized on, it was funnily enough, another roll of tape found at the crime scene, because that was found to have been contaminated as well, and that there was a mix-up with the little tubes where they collect the DNA samples. They recalled the DNA expert that they'd had at the start of the trial, at Joe Lee, and she told them how it appeared to her that there had been a switch in the little vials, and that piece of tape also had to be discounted.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of DNA evidence, the forensics work that's been done throughout this this whole investigation over the course of 2+ decades, the two key items in this are the water jug and a milk bottle. These are the things that the prosecution says has the DNA of Joseph Ocone and Steve Fabrizi on it, linking them to this crime scene where Irma Plasek is murdered. These items have been brought into the courtroom. They have been shown to the jury as they are in 2026. Why were these items brought in and shown to the jury? Haven't they heard enough about them? Have they seen enough photos of them by now?
Well, this is not unusual. It's kind of like, you know, when you see on CSI or detective shows, you see the sort of mood board they put up with pictures of the people in the scene. Mm. It's sort of like that. It's a way of bringing the crime home to the jury by showing them something so critical to the case that it sort of connects them to what's been alleged. And this often happens in murder trials, particularly where something like that will be presented to a jury so they can look at it, sometimes feel it, although in this case, the judge said to them, it's all been put back in its evidence bags for the moment, but the judge said to them, they would be allowed to take them out and have a look at them, but not put their fingers on them. And James might just explain how they were revealed to the court.
Surely, James, they're using gloves as they're going about this.
Very much so, and very much made a point of putting them on. So how they arrived in court is, if you imagine a large, clear, quite thick plastic bag, square, a bit like the ones when you go to the hardware shop or whatever, you know, the big green one with the sausages, and you buy like a big bag of fertilizer or potting mix or something like that. That sized, clear, no potting mix. Inside it were two brown bags, again, thick paper, little white stickers on that look a bit like the stickers that you get when you go and get your meds from the pharmacy or whatever, and they print your name like that. Mm. Printed out, the AFP logo, the AFP, Australian Federal Police, is on the outside of the bag. Craig Marriott's colleague brings up this bag, you know, holds it up, brings it up, this quite large bag. And then alongside it, there's a smaller plastic bag. Inside the smaller plastic bag is a box of gloves and a multi-tool with a knife on it. Craig Marriott puts on one glove, takes out the multi-tool, puts on another glove, then cuts the tape, the AFP branded kind of like packing tape that is around the top of these thick brown bags. It was really interesting because as he's cutting it, these bags are crinkling. And because he's in front of a microphone, because he's on the witness stand, you can hear this crinkling. Like when you get a package at home, you know, you come home after a day of work and you're like, oh, my things arrived in the brown cupboard. He was unwrapping it off, except obviously this is of much more consequence. So he takes the knife, he cuts through the tape, and he takes out of the bag first. It's such an everyday item. It's a 3-litre milk container that we've been hearing about all along. It's got a red lid. It's still got the Woolworths branding on it. Mm-hmm. It's pretty grubby. It's been obviously dusted for fingerprints, so it's sort of got a grey, powdery residue on it inside. It's kind of, you know, brownish and, you know, not amazing. There was a funny moment, actually, where Craig Marriott held up the bag and said, you know, 3 litre milk container and contents. And Justice Mossop said, does it still have milk in it? You know, bit of judge banter there at a crucial moment. That got a laugh from everyone. And then he held it aloft to show the court and, of course, the jury. It was then placed back in, and then he repeated that process with the water jug, and it had a pretty similar appearance, it has to be said. That one was double bagged, interestingly. Again, cut, changed gloves in between. He followed the Clifton Frost protocol, or the forensic protocol, swapped his gloves in between, got the jug out of the paper bag, held it up to the court, and then that was the end of the Crown case.
I mean, I have one crucial question here, James. Was there still milk in the milk bottle?
No, there wasn't, no.
Okay.
It did look a bit mouldy inside, didn't it, Liz, which you would expect.
Very, very festy.
Festy is
and
right.
And this wasn't helped by the fact that both items were covered in fingerprint dusting.
Mm, yeah. And, I mean, yeah, this is it. This is the penultimate moment in this trial, the end of the prosecution case, the defence not bringing any witnesses. How did this moment unfold in the courtroom?
That's the Crown's case, says Trent Hickey. You know, music swells in the film version of it. That's how it felt anyway. Justice Mossop then threw to the defence end of the bar table and no case was offered. Travis Jackson said, no case is offered, Your Honour. Scar Jerome stood up straight and said, on behalf of Steve Fabrizi, I offer no case, or words to that effect. And that was that.
And Liz, it's not unusual for the defence not to present a case. You know, they've been able to cross-examine all of the various witnesses that have come before court. So this isn't something that we should read anything into, is it?
No, not at all. In fact, in most trials, the defence reveals its case through the questioning of the Crown witnesses, which is exactly what we've seen.
Yeah. And what happens now, Liz? Closing statements?
Closing statements where each of the barristers will nail their colours to the mast, set out what they think has happened, tell the jury what decision they think they should make, and that will all be next week.
All right. Tuesday and next week, after the Easter break, a long weekend for everyone, we'll dive into the closing statements. I do want to get into some questions that we've been sent into the case of at abc.net.au, the email address you can reach us all at. Do love getting your emails, all of your questions, all of your feedback, all of your insights. There's one question that we have been asked so many times on the case of email that we can't answer yet, but we have filed away. So if you've sent us a question that you think is incredibly obvious, maybe something that reminds you of something you've heard previously, this is why we haven't mentioned it at this stage, but we are getting to it. Do have a question from Bianca that's been sent to the case of at abc.net.au. She's wondering whether any evidence has been led about the accused potentially knowing the victims before the home invasion, other than a possible link through the Hungarian community. Liz, James, what have we heard about whether the Palasics were known to Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Ficconi?
Well, we've heard only that there might have been someone in Victoria who might have said something to Joseph Ficconi, and that's how he knew the Palasics kept money and jewellery in their home. That's one thing that was posited at one stage. The other thing, though, which has been discussed in the last couple of days, is whether people knew that they were wealthy. Now, the first person on that list of 333 persons of interest was, in fact, Mr. and Mrs. Palasik's grandson. And he and a lot of his associates were investigated by police at the start of the whole investigation. And there's a person that he was connected to who actually helped arrange the secret compartment where the money and jewellery was held, and that only came to light in the last couple of days. So there was a general sense, and Craig Marriott said this to the court, that people did know they were wealthy, that wasn't something that wasn't kept from the, or wasn't unknown in the community. I suppose the real question is, who knew about the secret hiding space? And it appears that more people than just the family did know about that.
Yeah, got it. Thank you, Liz. And thank you, Bianca. Wonderful question. Appreciate you sending that. And one here from one of our overseas listeners. This is from Ella, who is listening from Germany. She notes that in episode 7 of the case of the two intruders, Joseph Acconi requested an interpreter during his police interview, and Craig Marriott said, "You've been here for a while. Let's see how we go," more or less. And the interview continued. Ella thought that everyone had a right to an interpreter and wonders whether or not this would make the interview inadmissible because one wasn't provided. Liz, has anything been spoken about or discussed about that?
Well, nothing's been discussed about that point, except other than that the interview just went ahead. Mm. The thing is, during that interview, which we all heard, Joseph Acconi clearly understood what he was being asked, and if he didn't, the police would repeat the question and make sure that he did understand what was being asked. So it was admissible. Mm-hmm. The problem, of course, with the interpreter is that he has needed to have one in court, and that's because the court goes at a much faster pace, so he can't stop and ask people all along the way, "What do you mean by that?" So a Hungarian interpreter has been, as we know, sitting beside him during the proceedings. So the original interview was certainly admissible, but he has required an interpreter for some of it because his English, while it's good, is not perfect.
And the most important questions that he was asked in the police interview are relatively simple. Have you ever been to Canberra? Were you there? Things like that, which, as Craig Marriott inferred, you know, when you've been in the country for 40-odd years, you should be able to answer those all. And if you can't, well, then we'll get you an interpreter. But as Liz said, they made it through those particular gates and Acconi denied the whole lot.
Wonderful. Thank you, James. Thank you, Liz. Thank you, Ella, for writing into thecaseof@abc.net.au. If you have any questions yourself you'd like us to answer, please get in touch. Thecaseof@abc.net.au is our email. We do love hearing from you as well, so please write to us. It's a lovely little pleasure to open the inbox each morning and see who's been in touch. Also, don't forget to grab ABC Listen. It's the best place to listen to not just The Case Of, but also all sorts of wonderful ABC content. And, you know, we're in the closing stages of this trial now, so it's important that you follow us there so you don't miss any of these moments. But with nothing between now and Tuesday happening in this trial, with closing statements not happening until Tuesday, we actually prepared something special for our next drop. So many of you have had questions about suppression orders, how the courts deal with this, why things are suppressed. So we've actually invited a former Supreme Court judge onto the pod, a woman who has jokingly referred to herself as the queen of banning things, Betty King. So we're dropping that into your feed on Tuesday. And then Liz, James, we're back in everyone's feed on Thursday with the closing statements. Looking forward to for both of you joining us then.
Thanks, Stocky.
Thanks, Stocky.
The Case of the Two Intruders is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. It's reported by Elizabeth Byrne and James Viver and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. A big thank you to our senior lawyer, our legal queen, Jasmine Sims, for her legal advice, to the ACT Newsroom and to Audio Studios manager, Eric George. This episode was produced on the land of the Ngunnawal, Ngambri and Wurundjeri people.